Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. My guest today is Bob Averly. Bob is professor of philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. His books include Democracy Gone and Anatomy of a Deception. We've talked about it before. It discusses the Iraq invasion, occupation, and there's always a preparation for another deception. You know, they just come on regularly, like clockwork. You know, like dusk follows dawn and dawn follows dusk. I mean, America's entire history is based on deception and duplicity and the rest of it. We know all that. Listeners to this program know that. Before I get on with Bob and discuss issues on his mind, certainly on my mind as well, let me just wish my condolences to the family and friends of Helen Thomas. I think a number of PRN listeners probably heard the news this morning. I didn't spot the date, but the Gridiron Club reported her death. She was age 92. I decided I have to write about her. I'm working on other articles today. I don't know if I can do it today, but I want to write about her. She really was iconic, a legend in her own time. She began covering presidents in 1960 when President Kennedy was only President Kennedy-elect. So during the Eisenhower administration, well, I'm old enough to remember Eisenhower and Truman and even Franklin Roosevelt. Not Roosevelt too well, but I remember him. There was no television. I heard him on radio live. I'm still alive to say so. Harry Truman, I remember better. We had some, I didn't have television at home while he was president, but there was television around, came out after the war, late 1940s. Certainly remember Eisenhower. I remember when he came to close by where I was going to school. Anyway, that's another story. But Helen was around all that time. Born in 1920, she finally was drummed out of journalism when she spoke truth to power. She said it a little bit injudiciously. She said something, and I'll get the exact quote in my article, something to the extent that the Jews should get the hell out of Palestine. What she really meant to say was the Israelis should get the hell out of Palestine, because Palestine belongs to the Palestinians and anyone who wants to live there peacefully. It's not for anybody who wants to brutalize Palestinians under militarized occupation. That's what she meant. I think the comment was off the cuff, and had she thought about it in advance, she probably would have written it out or planned it a little bit better the way a good journalist does. But, it's the way we do it on this program, on air. When you're being interviewed or when you're making comments, you have very strong feelings about major issues, and you say straightforwardly what's on her mind. Helen didn't mean to offend anybody. She spoke truth to power. She did it honestly, honorably, forthrightly. She certainly gets me to salute her for it, because I say these things all the time. Bob, welcome to the program. I wanted to get that in about Helen.
Well, I'm glad you did, Stephen. I think it's important to bring that up. I mean, she's really, as we discussed earlier this morning, she's the last of the legendary truth-telling journalists. You get a few people on the side like Jeremy Scahill and perhaps a few others who do some good investigative work, but when it comes to the daily confrontation of people in power, I don't think you can top Helen Thomas, and I don't think we're going to see her like again for quite a while.
Never in my lifetime, Bob. I'm going to characterize her this way. She was a one and only in mainstream journalism. You know, I mean, if you go back far enough, there were really historic figures like Edward R. Murrow, and he was a television figure. I guess during World War II, forget exactly what he did during World War II, but he had a famous CBS program that I've already written about. I have an article written I haven't gotten out yet, CBS Reports. He did remarkable documentaries on television. There was a great CBS News president, Fred Friendly, who believed in this kind of stuff on television, on national television. And he and Murrow and Murrow's co-pilot, I forget his name offhand, they teamed up to produce these remarkable documentaries for TV, the stuff that hasn't been around for decades. And the one I wrote about was Harvest of Shame, when he addressed the plight of migrant agricultural workers in America. And I bring that up in context to the article I wrote, and I'll wait till I get it out before readers will have a chance to see it. I won't hold it back too often, but there's breaking news stuff all the time, Bob. And even though there's stuff that I do and I put aside because it has a little longer shelf life, but the stuff that absolutely is stuff that needs to be gotten out right away, I can't sit on it. So if it's a serious story or if it's something else that's breaking news, I don't know if I can get an article written on Helen today. It may be more than I can do. I'm working on three other articles today, But I'm going to get on telling Helen's story as soon as I can and get it out. As soon as it's done, I'm going to get it out, and I do want to talk about her. One more thing, Bob, then you jump back in. I was trying to make contact with her. I wanted to invite her on this program. I couldn't do it. I felt awful. If I had made connections with her, I honestly thought we could have become good friends because we really believe in the same things.
You certainly do, and she was one of those who didn't hesitate to say what it was that she was thinking. So, and she based her statements on her own research and her own thinking through, rather than some type of emotion or some type of other secondary device that she could use to get across some type of intuition. She thought these things through, which is what made her so interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And when she became White House press corps director for UPI, I don't know when it began that she got to sit in the front seat and ask the first question. If I spot that, I'll certainly put it in my article. But for many decades, she was right there in the first floor. She was called the First Lady of the White House Press Corps. She always asked the first question. All the presidents knew her, and some of them even loved her.
And she got demoted after that flap that you were talking about, yeah. If I recall. Before she got canned, she got demoted.
Well, she was fired. She was fired.
She was still there through some other auspices, was she not? Before she got demoted from sitting in the front chair to sitting farther back, and then
fired. Yeah, that's right. That was before she got fired. She asked the right questions to the wrong person.
Well, that's right. That's why she got demoted, and then she made the comment about getting Israel. Was like you said, she meant to say Israel out of Palestine, and then it just went down from there.
Well, I would never be a White House press corps representative because I say these things about Israel and lots of other things that America gets involved with all the time, Bob, all the time. No punches pulled. That's why I think Helen and I would have been good friends. Privately, I think she would say to me candidly, what you say to me, they better not say that publicly anymore. And I'd say, well, Helen, I say it all the time, but I don't have to worry about getting expelled from the corps.
Yeah, that's a big position to be in, you know.
Oh, it really is. I mean, when you're independent and you do it as a volunteer, it's a different situation. The only thing I worry about is I know the CIA and FBI and the Mossad and the rest of them, NSA, you know, they monitor everything I do. But I'm out in the open and nothing about me is secret. So, I mean, I'm very easy for them to monitor. My emails, my phone calls, my media work, my articles, it's all there in public. I want it to be there in public.
It needs to be there in public, because if it's not, then there's no speaking of truth to power. So
that's exactly right. And I say nothing in emails privately that I don't say publicly in anything I write or anything I say on air. And the NSA reads all my emails. They know that's the truth.
Sure. Well, I mean, something that you're bringing up in that regard is that when you look at all of the news stories that have been coming at us, particularly since you and I last talked on the air, nearly all of the issues in the news now deal with government power over its citizens in one way or the other, and that includes the criminalizing of dissent. So it seems to me if there's any theme that kind of runs through all the various news stories that we're getting today, from the U.S. economy to the international economy to the environment to surveillance, all of those things, human rights and civil rights are now directly and squarely in the way of corporate profit and power. And that means government profit and power, because the two are the same today. So when you see that, the end result is that we are very fast moving from an authoritarian state to a totalitarian state. Now, just to make sure that nobody misinterprets me as being inflammatory, I want to say an authoritarian state is a state in which you have either an individual or a group of people that simply controls political power, and that's pretty much where it stops, with political power. But a totalitarian state attempts to control almost every aspect of political and social life, economy, education, science, morality, all of that is covered by a totalitarian state. So when you look at all of the news stories that are out today and you line them all up, what is the theme that comes through? To me, it's that idea of civil and human rights squarely in the way of corporate and state profit and power in all of these domains, which means that we're headed for totalitarianism. And so anything that we talk about in the next hour, I'd like to keep under that umbrella, because that's what I'm thinking as I look through all the news headlines and stories that I had lined up for this morning. That's the theme that comes through to me. So no matter where we go in the news over the hour, I think that's what we're going to see.
Bob, that's exactly what comes through to me as well. I mean, the things that are being done today are things that totalitarian states do. I use the word tyranny all the time. I talk about we have a tyrannical state, just short of full-blown tyranny. And you know, it's not that you and I say these things or give these opinions. We make these statements based on the things that are going on. When everybody is being spied on, when dissent is being targeted, when there are police state laws one after another on the books in America, they began before 9/11, but they proliferated after 9/11. I've written about most of them. I mean, they're all there in black and white. Anybody can find them, and individuals can judge for themselves. What do you call these laws? What do you call a Patriot Act that for the first time in history came up with a crime of domestic terrorism? Domestic terrorism? Well, supporting human rights, supporting animal rights, supporting environmental rights. If the government doesn't want you to do it, that makes you a domestic terrorism. If that isn't tyranny, Bob, I don't know what is.
That's exactly what it is. When you're branded a domestic terrorist, and you've got, and the government has the legal machination in place and the mechanisms to use to support that charge, that's tyranny. Chris Hedges had an article out this past Monday about that, I believe, called Locking Out Voices of Dissent, I think that's what it was called, where he talked about Snowden and the goal of the corporate state and all that kind of stuff. And he said, there's no other way to call it except tyranny. And he said, and if the United States government is successful in preventing dissent, which is what they're trying to do right now in public spaces, then dissent is going to have to take some type of mobilized form in terms of acts of resistance, nonviolent mass protests, sometimes clandestine nonviolent actions. This is Chris Hedges' response to his understanding of what you just said, that there's I call it totalitarianism. Tyranny is another word that is used, and he holds the same thing that you do.
Well, he lost the suits with others on the issue of targeting people who speak out responsibly, like he and other journalists. He won at the lower court, district court, federal court level, and an appeals court overturned his suit. His lawyer said, I wrote about it in the context of U.S. courts, approving indefinite detention, and that was Hedges' issue, and torture. And I combined those two issues in an article, a big article. I got it out yesterday, a very detailed article. It's on my blog site. It's easily accessed. And the title is U.S. Courts Approve Indefinite Detention and Torture. And that's exactly what they did. Usually it goes to the appeals court level. And there were a couple of lower court judges, at least one lower court judge that approved of what Hedges that sanctioned, I'm using the wrong word, that went along with Hedges' suit, but she was overruled at the appeals court level, appellate level, and Hedges' lawyer, representing him and others, indicate pretty strongly they'll appeal to the Supreme Court. But it's run by right-wing ideologues. I'm sure they'll get no. It's very rare that the Supreme Court, especially the Roberts Court, with others like Alito Thomas around it. It's very, very tough to get a ruling there. Even the so-called more liberal-minded ones, they're not liberal-minded ones. they're just a smidgen better than the worst of the worst. But it's a right-wing court. It's absolutely 100% pro-corporate. It's pretty much close to 100% pro-state. And this is the kind of rulings they come down with, and you can read them in the things they do. When they sanction things like $1 equals speech, you know, sanctioning unlimited money spent on political campaigns, there isn't enough in there already. And amount of money. It means, you know, you and I have a buck or two, Bob, and we get that much power, and the deep pockets with millions or billions, they get that many times more amount of power than we have. That's the kind of court it is. So winning in that court is almost impossible. When they turn you down or when they won't even hear your case, they do it summarily in about a one-liner that's very, very insulting. I've got it put away somewhere. You read it, and it is very, very insulting, demeaning, but that's the way they operate.
Yeah, and the ruling that you're talking about came from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York.
Yeah.
And it was a 3-0 decision, and they said the same thing that the Supreme Court, I know, is going to say, because one of the things the Supreme Court likes to say in regards to such cases as citizen rights for free speech and all of that, the Supreme Court likes to dismiss those suits on the grounds that the plaintiffs lack standing. If you remember the ACLU suit a couple years ago and other suits that have come up, when the Supreme Court turns them away, they use that legal line. They lack standing. That's exactly what the basis of Judge Lewis Kaplan's statement said when the Court of Appeals made their decision about the Hedges and Chomsky case, that they lack standing because the NDAA provision, the National Defense Authorization Act provision, doesn't say anything specifically about the president's ability to detain American citizens. So that's how they use the wiggle room available there to say, well, we can just dismiss this suit. Now, when Hedges and Chomsky and the others in this suit go to the Supreme Court, I'm going to bet you that that's exactly what the Supreme Court says to uphold the Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on the same grounds. You lack standing. And that's how they do it. They just really, I don't want to say disenfranchised, but they alienate these segments of society saying, well, you just don't have a legal standing.
Well, Bob, I will say this. Hedges and Chomsky ought to read my article, the one that I just mentioned about illegal detention and indefinite detention and torture, because the NDAA absolutely targets U.S. citizens. It's right there. You know, they use a lot of weasel word language, but it's very clear that it targets everybody, including U.S. citizens. I discuss it in my article. I explain it. Everybody is vulnerable. So anybody like Hedges or Chomsky or me or you, Bob, or anybody is targeted. They can come after me, and they can use NDAA to come after me, and they can do it based on that provision. But courts are supposed to be checks and balances. They certainly don't operate that way. They're supposed to challenge the law of the land when the law of the land obstructs another law, the Constitution, for example, international law, for example, which automatically, under the Constitution's Supremacy Clause, becomes the law of the land. So any international law that America is a signatory to is automatically U.S. law, and Congress may pass no laws to go against those inviolable laws. And it's the Supreme Court's obligation to say that and rule that way. And as far as U.S. citizens and NDAA, I know damn well I'm vulnerable. And Hedges, again, I repeat, and Chomsky, they ought to read what I had to say about it. They ought to know this stuff without reading my article, especially Chomsky. He reads virtually everything. But it's right there in black and white, Bob.
Oh, I'm sure they're very well aware of that. I mean, if you want to see how the Supreme Court works in this fashion, all you have to do is go back to what they did was last week or 2 weeks ago when they gutted the Voting Rights Act. So what happens if legislation that they don't like comes before them? How do they do that? Well, they just get rid of the legislation. So, I mean, that's pretty extreme power. So when they gut the Voting Rights Act and say, well, it's no longer applicable today, which is exactly what John Roberts said, then they basically serve as their own little group of dictators. They can say what they want and they can do what they want, and all they have to do is to give it some type of thin legal veneer saying, well, okay, the Voting Rights Act helped back in the 60s, but it doesn't help anymore, so we just get rid of it now. And they'll do the same thing with the Chomsky case as well.
Well, absolutely. It's tough enough fighting City Hall on a local level, Bob. It is tougher if you go to the state level, and if you take on Washington, my goodness, I mean, literally, it makes David versus Goliath looks like a pushover for David. I mean, that really is a monster struggle. Just the fact that they have deep pockets and they can literally wear you down and grind you down, and if you get too close to beating them, I mean, they can threaten you, and if they want to, they can kill you.
Well, they're certainly, yeah, they can kill you, and they don't have any problem doing that, but they're certainly moving that way when you take a look at a couple of the programs that are going on right now. You've got the CIA program that's called Honor the Oath, I think, that they're attempting to squelch all possibilities of leaks that John Brennan had written. It's a new CIA official policy that's really supposed to engage in complete corporate secrecy, and I mean corporate in the general sense, not the business world, but they're saying that no one can engage in any leaks about what the CIA is doing, and then that couples up with Obama's insider threat program, which is saying keep an eye on your fellow employees and make sure that your coworkers are limiting themselves to just what they're supposed to do, and if they demonstrate any type of proclivity toward anything that may result in a leak or some type of erratic behavior that doesn't fit with the government prescription, turn them in. So you've got the CIA saying, we're not going to tolerate any leaks, turn them in, or we'll get to you. And then you got Obama saying, if you're working for the government, turn in your fellow employees. I remember when I grew up, one of the things that my teachers and parents always told me about that this made the Soviet Union such an evil place was that they had everybody spying on each other and turning each other in. That's what we've got going on right now. And it's being done big time inside the government, but as we know now, it's being done outside the government. So the U.S. officials are now using driver's license databases to conduct local police searches. We now know because of the ACLU that millions of us are being tracked through license plate scanning systems that are all through the country right now. You had Comey testifying on Capitol Hill saying, yes, we do use surveillance drones now in the United States and that we could possibly weaponize those in the future. You had the U.S. Postal Service saying, yes, we examine and photograph every regular package coming through. This is a complete clampdown on citizens under power. So we got to wake up to this. And as Chris Hedges said, there's not many options left except direct action of some sort. And Hedges advocates the nonviolent action, which would be the only option that you got.
Well, I absolutely believe it with that. And civil disobedience, Bob, is a noble tradition in America and in other parts of the world. And I'm absolutely an advocate of civil disobedience. I say it proudly. I say it openly. I recommend it. I don't believe in violence. I think violence only begets more violence. But civil disobedience, some of America's best have engaged in civil disobedience. And I'm proud to say that I'd be very happy to stand beside them and do exactly the same thing. If we don't resist, Bob, this stuff is going to get worse and worse. And if people think they can go to the ballot box and change things, they are very, very sadly mistaken. It has never happened in human history. Virtually nowhere. There's an occasional exception. The exceptions prove the rule, like Venezuela. But if Venezuela comes along maybe once in a lifetime, and there certainly is nowhere where else on earth that I know of where this has ever happened, because it doesn't exist anywhere on earth. You either rattle their chains and you do it persistently and you do it over a long enough period, or you get nowhere. And in the case of what's happening in America, you're on a slippery slope to oblivion, and that's exactly what's happening in America. We are a police state now here. We are a tyrannical state, and we're heading for full-blown tyranny. And by my definition of that is, you know, they try to mask it now. They wrap it in the American flag. They prettify it. But the full-blown variety is when they strip off the mask and they declared martial law, and there is a national emergency, been one since 9/11, but they make it open, and they blaze it in headlines all the time. People don't even know there's a national emergency. It gets renewed every single year. For what reason? For no reason, because they want to do it. So they can say there's a national emergency. They can do anything they damn please, and they do. But when they declare martial law, the way they did in Boston after those two brothers were set up, they're absolutely innocent. I've said it on this program, and the evidence keeps mounting to prove it. They absolutely were innocent, had nothing to do with those bomb attacks. But when that happens and the city gets militarized and locked down for a couple of days, martial law, no law, suspend local law, constitutional law by the boards, people get rousted out in the street pre-dawn, resist, get shot on the spot if the cops want to do it with impunity. Well, that's coming to other neighborhoods. That's coming across America. That's going to come openly, and that's my definition of full-blown tyranny.
Yeah, you know, the thing that bothers me about that the most, I think, is not so much the declaration of martial law, because I've seen us inching that way. So, I mean, it's predictable that you get these certain things that happen, and it gives the government a pretext to declare martial law in that particular area. I mean, you could see that coming. And so that was disturbing enough, and it really caused a great deal of cognitive problems for me to see that. But what really got to me with the Boston thing was when they lifted martial law, the people were coming out on the streets with their American flags and they were chanting USA, USA. So there are people there that were cheering on the fact that they were put under martial law.
Yes.
Until that happened. Now, if that doesn't change, then I don't think we can expect anything in terms of what the government actions are in terms of declaring martial law in an area like Boston or across the nation. There's nothing that's going to stop them from doing that. And there's still what you said. You mentioned Venezuela a little earlier. There's the exact same thing going outward, too, in terms of foreign policy. When Venezuela offered Snowden asylum, this was a news story actually just this morning that I had read, a Spanish newspaper wrote the details of an interview that they did with Venezuelan Foreign Minister Elias Wuja, I don't know how you say his name, but he gave the details to the Spanish newspaper about a phone call that Secretary of State John Kerry made to him, telling him all the things the United States was going to do if they dared to try to bring Snowden to Venezuela. And I counted in the article four different things. Kerry said that what the United States would do is ground all Venezuelan airplanes flying in American or NATO airspace. And he said even if the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, was flying, they would ground that plane too, because Kerry said, according to this article, immunity is for the person of the president, not the plane he's flying in. So that's one threat. Second threat, they'll revoke all U.S. entry visas to Venezuelan citizens into the United States. Third threat, bring criminal drug charges and drug trafficking and money laundering charges against specifiedly named officials of the Venezuelan government. And the fourth threat, halt all sales of U.S. gas products to Venezuela. Venezuela purchases about, I don't know, about 500,000 barrels of gasoline each month. So those are pretty heavy threats. So during a press conference with the U.S. State Department deputy spokesperson, her name is Marie Harf, she said, oh, no, we didn't make any threats against Venezuela. We just said that Snowden was accused of very serious crimes, and then if Venezuela didn't cooperate with us, we would take whatever appropriate response we wanted to at that time. Well, what's the difference between that and the specifics about what Kerry did? But the big issue here is those are two direct violations of the United Nations Charter. Both of them come under Article 2, which says that the sovereign equality of all nation members of the UN is to be respected. And it also says specifically in paragraph 3 that all members have to refrain in their international relations from any threat or use of force against any other independent nation. So just in those threats, the United States has violated two international laws. So you got dictatorship at home and abroad here with our foreign policy, and that's just one instance. There are many others that we could talk about through the remainder of the hour about what the United States is doing. That's real bullying.
Well, Bob, one of my articles tomorrow is on what you just discussed, and everything you mentioned is in my article, including violating the U.S. Charter and the things that Kerry said he will do to Venezuela. I mean, absolutely outrageous. I call my article, it'll be on my blog site tomorrow, it'll get pretty good distribution. I call it Venezuela bashing. It certainly isn't the first time. It's been ongoing since Chavez took office in February 1999. So this is, you know, about 14 years in running, and under Chavez, under Maduro, I think it just gets the Venezuelan people and the leadership of Venezuela absolutely incensed to say we're just not going to take this crap. And the thing I love most about Chavez is he just came out and said it. Well, Maduro comes out straightforwardly and says it at times too, and he did make some very pointed comments about the stuff that was said. No, he made comments about Samantha Power. We can talk about her in the second half of the hour. She made some very, very disparaging comments about Venezuela, and also she made horrific comments supporting the worst of Israeli crimes and bashing Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, on and on and on. This despicable woman, you and I exchanged emails on her, Bob. I called her an example of a pure evil is what I called her. That's exactly what she is. She'll replace Susan Rice as UN envoy. She'll be confirmed by the Senate. I think the Armed Forces Committee? Well, the Senate Committee, she testified before. I think they've already vetted her and okayed her. But, she'll clear the Senate in a breeze if she hasn't done it already. So, and Susan Rice didn't need confirmation. She's National Security Advisor. They're both criminals. They're both criminals. Power's been in the administration before, and we can discuss her more in the second half. But this bashing of Venezuela and all the rest of it, I mean, this is the way a rogue state operates, Bob. They just throw their weight around. I mean, they'll even do it against powerful states like Russia. I've got another article I put out today. Is it today or tomorrow? It's going out tomorrow. It went out today. I'm sorry. I call Putin bashing. Russian bashing redux. It really is Putin bashing. Russia convicted a crook. a crook, a guy named Alexei Navalny, a crook. He stole $500,000. And I mean, I asked in my article why they bothered going after him, because corruption in Russia is so widespread, and the big fish just walk free and nobody puts a glove on them. So why they go after this guy? He's a small-time politician, a financial wheeler dealer. He's a mayoral candidate for Moscow. He'll run in the election. He's out on bail. He's appealing his conviction 5 years, and he probably will stay free, probably until the Moscow election in September. He might have gotten 5 or 10% of the vote. Maybe now he'll get 15%. I don't know why they gave him any more prominence than he deserves, but he's tied to the U.S. State Department. He gets State Department funding through the National Endowment of Democracy. You know the kind of scum of the earth these people are, Bob. I mean, they betray their own country for a buck. And I don't care about the $500,000. I care about betraying your own country a lot more than that. And that's exactly what Navalny is guilty of. So I have to write about him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he gets a lot of time on Russia television, too, if you read or watch RT and read their stories.
Oh, yeah.
They really kind of like him, and they talk about how he's gaining in popular support, maybe because Putin is putting a thumb on him. Who knows? But it's not just Russia that the United States is doing this in Venezuela. They're doing it in Germany, too. The NSA has, in their spying in Germany, has been working with German police. And I don't know if you read about this, but earlier, gosh, it's about 2 weeks ago now, there's a guy whose name in the press is only Daniel or Daniel B., who posted on his Facebook page kind of this humorous little anecdote that he was going to try to walk along endangered sites, including exploring the threatened habitat of the NSA spies in Germany or something like that. The NSA in the United States was eavesdropping on his Facebook page, and so they connected up with the German police, and the German police, after he posted this on his Facebook page, went to his door and interrogated him about what he was saying, what he meant, whether he was associated with any groups that advocated violence, what political groups he liked, et cetera, et cetera. And then he ended up getting a call from a higher-up in the German police investigative unit, who also came to his house and demanded that he say nothing about the fact that he had been, that he'd had two visits from two different sets of police officials who were contacted by the American NSA about what he said he was going to do. But he posted it on his Facebook page anyway. And so what happened was he actually put out there the date that he was going to take a walk over to this installation. I can't remember what city it was in anymore, but he ended up having like 80, 85 people join him, and they walked over to this place. I think it's called the Dagger Complex, but I don't remember where it was. But the police walked with them. They had a helicopter over them, and they escorted them the whole way. And the problem that some of the German press is seeing in that is that they had the secret police operation that ended in this for just one guy that was in cahoots with the United States NSA because of their spying, and it's all about the alleged war on terror. But the notion of the secret police and secret police operations was banned after World War II because of Hitler's Gestapo, but now you got all this underway again because of the United States influence. So you can see America's dirty hands in each of these instances, Venezuela, Russia, Germany, all around. And that, so it's got to stop at home. We got to respond at home.
It sure has to stop at home. And my feeling is it needs to be stopped by anyone at home and by any world leader bold enough to tell America, we're not going to take this crap anymore. That's why we needed Chavez. That's why Obama murdered Chavez. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Anyway, I wrote about it. We'll take a break. We'll come back. back, talking to Bob Abele. We're covering a lot of ground, Bob. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I want to let you jump back into another topic or whatever else you feel that you want to get some comments in on, so please do.
I'll do that. I'd like to ask you one real quick question about we left off before the break with your comment about Chavez and the murder of Chavez. You know, when Chavez died, in my own demented humor, just to myself, I kept saying, well, the America probably killed him. But I'd never read anything that said that showed that there was any evidence that America was involved in that. So could you talk about that for a minute before I move on with the next topic? Well, you said you'd written about it.
Yeah, I did write about it. It's been a number of months now, but I also wrote about the fact, and this was the belief of the doctor of Yasser Arafat, and there's a lot of evidence to prove that Israel poisoned Yasser Arafat. They did it very cleverly, but they did it, and they killed him, and the evidence is very strong. You know, smoking gun, maybe it stops a little short of smoking gun, like the 9/11 evidence, but it is so overwhelming that you almost cannot come up with another conclusion. Chavez had whatever specific cancer he had. His condition was almost unprecedented. He needed 4 major surgeries in 18 months. Who ever heard of anything like that? He also had the best medical care possible. You just can't get any better, more extensive professional medical care than Chavez got. I mean, when you're president, you literally can get that, and he could have gotten it virtually anywhere. I don't know about America, but he certainly could have gotten it throughout Latin America, or most of Latin America, in Venezuela, and he chose to get it in Cuba, which has a medical system on a par with America in most respects. And you can bet that they gave him not 5-star treatment, but 10-star treatment. And yet, the cancer kept coming back after they thought they cured him. It just kept coming back, you know, like bad breath. He couldn't get rid of it. And finally, the fourth time, it was so virulent, it just took him, it spread, there was nothing they could do to stop it. And I truly believe that in some way they poisoned him, they got this stuff into his system, and whatever they did to do it, I don't know. But these people are very clever, and Fidel Castro warned Chavez, oh, long before this happened, and I quoted Castro verbatim, it was something like, be careful what you eat, be careful what you drink, these people will stop at nothing. Well, they tried to kill Castro hundreds of times. They never did it, but they came close, very close, one time, and miraculously he survived. He's still living. He's about 86, 87 now, really remarkable, and he came through a very tough illness a few years ago. Well, Chavez, about 55, 56 years old, he had many, many good years ahead of him. America wanted him dead. I don't think there's any question about that, and I honestly believe, and what we do know, Bob, suggests very strongly, short of a smoking gun, that America killed him, and I absolutely believe it. I've had that stuff published on lots of websites that don't publish this kind of information unless they believe it's true, including Global Research.
Well, that's kind of curious. I'll have to go dig that up then, because I've not read anything about that, so I was just kind of curious about that. Again, I was just saying it in my own head. I never even said it out loud to anybody, but that there is some evidence that people are collecting, I find kind of interesting to look at. So anyway, the movement that you asked for the next topic that I wanted to talk about, one of the things that I think it's going to be really important for us to do as citizens in being able to come together to do some type of resistance to this movement into totalitarianism that we're seeing right now, we have to get rid of this notion that individualism is the primary philosophy that we should be operating by. We have seen the debacle of Ayn Rand philosophy. We have seen what individualism has done to the corporate fabric, and I mean that corporate in a large sense, the communal fabric. The notion that relativism of all ethical values is the prominent position to take, we've seen the problems with that. And you've asked me a couple of times what book that I'm working on right now. It's taking a really long time to do, but that's what I'm going after, relativism of American culture, the individualism of American culture. When you get rid of those notion of objective ethical values and you replace it with a relativism of anything goes or my world is my own world, you automatically give up this notion that there is a common good, and you automatically give up the notion that there is something called truth that needs to be spoken. and then you give up any type of activism, and all you have basically are ideologies that are in competition with one another. So the object of my new book is to say we'd better come back to these notions of thinking critically and what ethical values really are about, and get rid of this notion of I can do whatever I want in my own world, because there's nothing that is going to allow that to gel us together in any way, and that's what's been broken apart, the notion that we're all in this together. So we have to kind of respond together by understanding that there are certain values that we do stand for, that we can't let those go away, otherwise we end up under a totalitarian system. And I think one of the problems that we're going to run into is from ALEC, because I was reading the other day that ALEC has 139 bills to get rid of public education, and they're zeroing in on those types of critical thinking courses and majors in colleges. They're trying to take over with this getting rid of public school, and now in 16 states, they're going to start overturning the public schools and putting in private schools in which you have a very limited academic pursuit, all done in the guise of corporate profit and all done for getting people ready to go back into working with those corporations or for those corporations. So there's a full-blown attack coming on education. And if that is successful, then the idea that I was just talking about thinking about ethical values and relativism and what is true and what is right, those things go away, because they destroy those by putting in for-profit schools that are focused on profitability for corporations and getting people ready for the workplace. You lose all of that, and then you lose the idea of citizenship. So I think we need to take a real close look at the last bastion of public good, the educational system in America. ALEC has zeroed in on it. So have the right-wingers. We've seen the problems in Philadelphia. We've seen the problems in New York. We've seen the problems right in your backyard in Chicago. And that would be a good place to start organizing and put a stop to this totalitarian run that people like ALEC are involved with.
Well, I certainly concur with that, Bob, and I concur with anything that anyone can do to really challenge the growing injustices that literally increase all the time, and that the comment you made about the people of Boston literally applauding what was done to them, I mean, it shows the struggle that we have, that people simply don't realize that when the liberties, their vital liberties are being stripped away from them, do they actually think this is being done for their own good? Do they think that the authorities are protecting them by doing this? It's astonishing that this kind of stuff happens. And before we took the break, I wanted to make the comment that other people have certainly said this, and I've repeated it, that Americans are the most uninformed, over-entertained people in the world, and it shows when the response to a horrific police state act that nobody should tolerate is literally applauded by people who stupidly think it's done to benefit them. And this is the big struggle that we face to overcome that hurdle.
And when you've got this Bill Gates and the Walton family of Walmart, who are very public in this idea of revolutionizing education, that's what they call it. The idea that that Bill Gates has said this forthrightly, literature, critical education, he calls it critical education, music, and those dimensions that bring us together and get us to think about what we stand for and what our culture is about, those are going to be sacrificed in favor of a set of standard exams that get people through the system with a very narrow purview. So they really want to radically alter all of this so that there is no critical thinking and no information about politics and social life and culture. It's just basic math and reading, and you scaffold that level up through the community college level, and then you get them back into, once they get through the standardized test, you get them back into the marketplace. So that's what they're focused on. And I don't see how we're ever going to be able to come back around to a notion of critical thinking and overcoming relativism and getting together and looking at the common good if we don't have that stuff being discussed in our schools, because I don't think it's going to be discussed anywhere else. Back to what you were saying, people don't really know those things unless they walk into a classroom where those type of things are being discussed, or unless they read your articles or my articles, or they're in touch with websites like Global Research and other websites that do discuss those issues. We just don't have that. I mean, you turn on TV and all you get is basic entertainment stuff. So, and now we've got in California a much more serious problem, and we've got Janet Napolitano, Obama's former chief of Homeland Security, coming to run the UC system. And all of her background is being relentless in her attack on education and cutting. I mean, when she was in Arizona, she cut $100 million from the Arizona State University system and another $40 million from state colleges, while at the same time letting administrator salaries rise. So there's this ongoing onslaught to keep people stupid and uneducated. That's where I think we got to start. So in general, that's where the book I'm working on focuses. But I think in activism, that's where we got to start too. And it's happened in Chicago, and it's happening in New York. So there are little glimmers of hope in which people are starting to pull together. And I think people are starting to wake up to this, but we need to do it really quickly. Otherwise, it's going to be way too late. Maybe way too late already, I don't know. But you got to hold out hope. If you don't, there's no reason for us to even be talking.
Oh, I agree. Hope is our last line of defense, Bob. No matter how dark things look, I absolutely refuse to give up hope as far as education goes. I mean, there was real public education, even inner city public education, like for kids like me in inner city Boston, who went to a high school that stopped existing decades ago, a high school that most of the kids went on to nondescript careers, but some of them, a fair number, went on to college. And a fair number went on to some of the top schools. I was lucky enough to make it that way, and when they were affordable. And it's absolutely impossible today. The schools are gone. I mean, I'm talking about public education, and there's been a war on public education going on, especially since the Bush years, and Obama continues it, this notion of race to the top and no child left behind. These are code words for privatizing education and making them all bottom line priorities for corporate predators. So, you know, you've got war profiteers, you've got health care profiteers, you've got education profiteers. These people want everything privatized. So let big corporations rip us off, make every buck they can out of it, and give us as little back as possible for what they charge. And that's the kind of country this is being turned into. Plus all the police state laws that target anybody who challenges the system. Well, we damn better challenge the system, Bob, because we're losing everything, and it's happening in plain sight. And again, to me, the number one problem is too few people understand it, and they're the ones who are most at fault, because if they don't stand up and fight this thing, when will they wake up? When they realize they've lost it all, they have no rights, their kids have no rights, is that when they'll get mad? Well, that's not the time to get mad. Today is not the time to get mad. Yesterday was. Last week, last year, 10 years ago, that was the time to get mad. You didn't do it then, you damn well better do it now.
We better do it now. I mean, there's nothing left. It's actually gone, as you know, beyond just the domestic scene to now people are talking about TAFTA, you know, the Transatlantic Trade Agreement, where the United States is flexing its muscle there, too, allowing corporations to sue various nations who engage in laws and practices that they, the international corporations, don't like. And the United States is saying, hey, we don't want any of that. So they talk about, let's do mutual recognition of standards. Well, the mutual recognition simply means for the U.S., as the U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk said, all trade barriers are to be removed. Corporate power is to reign supreme, allowing the corporations to sue governments who put laws in place that impede their profits. This is very clear, and it's very evident in the negotiations that are going on right now. So the idea is corporations control everything from education to international trade and international finance. No government is permitted to challenge them, and that means the people cannot challenge them. So you've got a lot of very heavy economic muscle behind these movements against education and at the same time against international governments, Kraft and Nestle and Walmart and Cargill and Monsanto and all those companies are involved in this whole push. And it's a push outward toward other nations and other governments and a push inward against the education system and against the people. As Chomsky has said in an interview that was printed not too long ago, that what Obama and the government of the United States particularly are doing is they're taking on their worst feared enemy, and that is the people of the United States and the people of the world. And I think Chomsky's got an idea there, and you can see that in all the things we've talked about. Joseph Stiglitz has been writing about that, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, saying, take a look at TAFTA, this transatlantic free trade agreement, because in that you see all of the things that people talk about on domestic levels in the United States. You see it going on internationally now. So there's two areas that we can focus on, education and this idea of corporate power rules the world. Governments have no say. If governments have no say, people have no say. So we'd better get busy.
Oh, indeed. You get all of these trade agreements. You get the global ones. Began with the World Trade Organization, World Trade Organization and NAFTA came along just about at the same time,
right.
1993, 1994. NAFTA was effective January 1, 1994. I remember that, and I remember the day so well because I knew where I was. I remember where I was on that day, and that was the day NAFTA began, and it was really a cataclysm of events. It caused a lot of uproar in Mexico and that part of the world. But then we had other bilateral agreements, and you've got this TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership. You've got an Atlantic Partnership that's being negotiated. Same deal on the other side of the world. And as you say, Bob, it's to give corporations supreme unchallenged power and to take everything away from the people. It's to continue the unprincipled and unprecedented wealth transfer from the 99% of the population to the top 1% until they have it all and the rest of us have nothing. And that's exactly the scheme that they have in mind. You know, serfdom for the majority. Untold riches that Croesus couldn't even imagine for the privileged of America and the selected partners around the world. That's the system they have in mind. That's the Bilderberg idea. You know, a class of society with rulers and serfs. That's their language.
Avarice knows no bounds, does
yep.
it? There's back to that value thing. There's no value, so I'll just do whatever I want, and you're going to do. It's a matter of power at that point. Who's got the most power? And power means money in a capitalist society. So I'm on board with the socialists. Let's get rid of capitalism, and then you can get a government of, by, and for the people again. But short of that, short of following Richard Wolff's suggestions about what to do, I don't see much hope that we're going to have. But Richard Wolff's got some good ideas about all of that that you're talking about. The idea that start organizing locally and start doing businesses locally. There's a real angle that we might want to take in terms of how to respond to all of this. This idea that that we're going to be hit with actually pretty soon. Ron Paul has got his own TV station now, and he's advocating the virtues of what he's calling libertarian populism. And I know that Paul Krugman in the New York Times wrote an article on that earlier this week. That's a real crazy idea. It's completely delusional. The idea that everybody could run around making all their own money and that would be the type of social fabric that you want is just not, it's really a pure fantasy. Excuse me. So that's what we're going to see come next, that we're going to see the over-entertained people getting a real nice libertarian populism message that says, be as wealthy as you want, do what you think is necessary for your own profit, it's all good. But the game's already been fixed and pretty much won in that regard. So it's just a pure fantasy to say, well, everybody can win at this, but that's the message that's going to be coming. Everybody can win. And people who aren't astute about what this libertarian right-wing stuff is, they're going to go with it and think that they can win. I see it with my students. They take this on and say, yeah, it's the American dream. We can win at this. We can actually become wealthy just like anybody else. And I keep saying to them, you're buying into an ideology. You're not buying into what the evidence allows you to say, that you get a fantasy life that's being constructed for you by the people who already own the money and have the power.
Oh, indeed so, Bob. It saddens me, and yet it energizes me at the same time. It literally gives me a reason to get up every day. I mean that so much. Next month, I'll be 79 years old. I'm not a kid anymore, but I've still got lots of energy. Maybe Obama will try to kill me and get rid of me the way he got rid of Chavez. Who knows? I certainly don't have the persona that he has or the influence that he has.
Don't eat GMO foods.
Well, I try to stay away from GMO foods. I don't believe in putting poison in my body. It's impossible to stay away from them entirely, but I do the best I can. The ingredients of the insidious stuff, you just don't know what the hell you're getting because they don't tell you. But I literally have a reason to get up every day in the morning, and I look forward to it. I look forward to the challenge of saying, now what should I tell people about today, and whether I have my own program or whether I have interviews. I have a lot of interviews. I get interviews sometimes on a daily basis. I had two yesterday, one the day before, and the last week I probably had half a dozen or more, and I just yearn for the possibility of being able to talk about these issues and tell people stuff they need to know. And for me, it's a volunteer situation. Nobody pays me. Nobody tells me what to say or write about. I'm a complete free agent, and I feel lucky to be able to do that. And it's the energy that drives me, and it's what I want to do every day. This is the way I want to go down. I just hope I have a long time to go. And it certainly beats fishing and golf and the rest of it, Bob.
It does, indeed. And there is something I wanted to ask you while we were on the air. Excuse me. I know you've had Harvey Wasserman on your show before.
Yes.
But have you talked to him lately about what's going on with Fukushima? Because there is Scientific American has just released this really disturbing report about the amount of radiation that we're getting right here in California, that the kelp alone off the coast of California is 250 times higher in levels of radiation than it has been before Fukushima, and it goes on and on and on from there. And you probably are aware of all of that yourself and how TEPCO is covering this up and how Obama has told the United States government, the Environmental Protection Agency, don't study this, don't measure it, set it aside, don't say anything about it. And the release of radiation by dumping radioactive water into the ocean and all that stuff.
Bob, I wish we had more time. I do know a little bit about this, and I've written a little bit about it. I wrote a lot about Fukushima when it happened, and I wrote an article. My last article on Fukushima was maybe 2 or 3 months ago. I'll probably have to revisit it, and I know this stuff is happening, and I know there's a massive cover-up about the radiation that doesn't just affect California. It blankets the country in most parts, and it covers a lot other parts of the world. I've got to sign off, Bob, because I am out of time. I'll remind listeners to tune in tomorrow, every weekend at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, for programs like this, for information you need to know. Tell others about it. Tell them about PRN. Make this program, make other programs on PRN, a regular habit.